we could turn it up, that'd be great.
Yeah, I'm David Paul with the Board on Judicial Standards. That sounds better.
Perfect.
Yeah. Thank you, Chairperson Hellstrom, and thanks to the committee for providing me this opportunity to appear. Thanks also to Charlotte. I don't know where she is, but I appreciate her.
Right next to you.
In the last biennium, the board received an appropriation of $456,000 for each year. This includes a special line item of $125,000, which is limited strictly to professional services. These are the investigative costs and the costs of the public hearing, public hearings that we have, such as.
I'm going to interrupt you for just 1 second. Does everyone have their budget book with them? And if not, there are extras that are over on the cart if you haven't picked up your book yet. I apologize. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chairman Hellstrom. The professional services include things like the investigative costs, the costs of public hearings, court reporters, copying, lawyers' fees. This is what the $125,000 special line item is dedicated to. The basic operating budget is $331,000. The governor has once again recommended that this amount be appropriated to the board, $331,000 for the base budget and the $125,000 revolving line item for the investigative costs. The governor has additionally recommended that funds be immediately made available to our agency for costs incurred in connection with three matters. The first is a continuing public disciplinary hearing, and there are also two continuing confidential disability matters involved in this also. The governor, these expenses will exceed our current appropriations, including the funds that have been dedicated to the special line item for investigations and lawyers' fees. In the disciplinary case, the judicial officer who is subject to the matter is alleged to have engaged in serious judicial misconduct. And in the disability matters, the disciplinary matter is public, and you can see whatever you need to see. Our website contains the complaint and the judge's answer. But the disability matters is not public. They are confidential at this time also. And what the board is trying to do is, in terms of its rules, is to determine whether or not the physical or mental condition of the judges that are involved in the matters seriously interfere with their capacity to perform judicial duties, which is the standard contained in our rules. So that is what we are going for right now. When, as now, the board is presently involved in these judicial disciplinary or disability matters, and as I said, there are three of them. The formal investigations, the public hearings, are required by the board's rules. The rules require that the board justify any proposed contested discipline or disputed discipline or action or on the disability cases. Doesn't matter. We are held to the clear and convincing evidentiary standard, and this evidentiary standard must be met before a panel of three persons, typically a retired judge, a lawyer, and a member of the public. The public member is usually a former member of the board. The hearings also provide the judicial officer, who is subject to the complaint, with an opportunity to adduce evidence and produce and cross-examine witnesses, and there's a lot of due process built into that process also. So the judge gets to benefit from that and has a full opportunity to present his or her case. The decision of the hearing panel is then rendered, and if either party is wants to contest the decision, either the judge or the board, then the Supreme Court is petitioned and a final review is had before that court. Other than the revolving fund account, costs for these formal hearings are typically not included in our agency's appropriation because the number and the scope and the timing is completely out of our control. We never know what we're going to hear of or what we're going to have to investigate until we get it, and it comes at any time it wants, and pay any attention to whether it's a budget year or not. And it just can't be determined in advance. And this is the problem. We have enough money to start these cases, which is the purpose for the revolving fund, and we are extremely grateful for that. It's the amount of money we can save and save the state is great, and it gives us a chance to start them at a proper time, but sometimes we just can't finish them.
And we're going to interrupt with some questions here. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm sorry for the interruption in the middle of the testimony, but you were talking about some of the procedures there for when a judge is brought before you. When a judge comes before you, is that public record that judge is appearing before your board? I guess that's a first question.
Go ahead.
You know, it depends on when the judge comes before us. If in a normal sense, there is a period of confidentiality, which we observe, and when we get a complaint, for example, we process that complaint confidentially. And at first, we don't even tell the judge that we have the complaint. We first review it to see that the allegations are within our power and that there's some evidence to support those allegations. The board, at that point, usually decides to get a little more information. At that point, it will advise the judge that a complaint has been filed, give it to him or her, let him have him or her give us a response, and we go from there. What usually happens after that is the judge is given a proposed discipline, which the judge can either accept or reject. And if the judge accepts it, sometimes the discipline is private and the whole case remains private. Sometimes the discipline is public, in which case the judge agrees to it and a public reprimand is issued. If, however, the judge disputes the discipline as being appropriate, then it goes to the public hearing, which is the procedure that I was describing with the panel and eventually landing on the desk of the Supreme Court.
Okay. So,
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So what I'm hearing you say then is it may or may not become public depending on the nature of what he's being, I don't know, charged or accused of or whatever. I'm not clear on when the public gets to see what's going on exactly and how they would know if a complaint has been made about a particular judge. I'm not.
Mr. Paul.
Madam Chair. Yeah, the complaint becomes public in two instances. First of all, if the discipline proposed is public and the judge agrees to it. That's one.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Let him finish the answer.
The second time is when the board is its proposal has either been disputed or it feels that it just must go to a hearing. In that case, it files the case in with the Supreme Court, and then, of course, it's immediately public. So those are the two ways it becomes public.
Representative Scott.
Thank you. And why wouldn't a disciplinary action, can you give me an example of why a particular disciplinary action wouldn't be made public?
Mr. Paul.
Madam Chairperson. I can give you, yes, of course, many examples. For example, let's say that a judge, under the law, many motions and many final orders must be rendered within 90 days under 546.27. Let's say that a judge renders one in 97 days. That's a seven-day limit outside the statutory limit. It's not a very heinous violation of the code, yet it is a violation of the code. And the board does a great deal of its work underneath the public line, in other words, privately, for many good reasons. But one of the reasons is that it's actually the only axe it has to wield in terms of getting a settlement. And in other words, when a case goes public, its nature changes immediately. But the board makes a lot of good decisions and does the judiciary and the public a lot of good by just staying in the private sector. This is why its duties are divided between the confidential or the private sector and the public sector.
And so basically what you're saying is it's up to the board's discretion as to whether that goes public, the penalty.
Mr. Paul.
Madam Chairperson, it's not quite in the board's discretion. Even if it proposes some you know, sometimes they, I mean, these matters become public apart from the board and apart from the complaint system. But in terms of the board, yes, if it proposes something which is private, that usually remains private. And if it proposes something public, then it becomes public.
Representative McNamer.
Madam Chair, I heard, are we talking about discipline, reprimand, or dismissal?
Mr. Paul.
Madam Chairperson, if it's a public reprimand, obviously that's public, and if it's dismissal, that's obviously, it's not always public, the dismissal. Sometimes we get judges to agree to remove themselves, but that's the kind of harsh punishment, harsh discipline that would more than likely give rise to a public hearing.
Madam Chair, may I ask, is it subjective or objective?
Mr. Paul.
I don't think I quite understood the question.
Do you have concrete evidence or is it speculation?
Mr. Paul, I believe he's asking about the proof.
Right.
Oh, yes.
Mr.
Madam
Paul.
Chairperson, we are under a clear and convincing standard. We must have sufficient evidence to move before we feel constrained by that, and if we don't feel that we have clear and convincing evidence, then we don't move.
Representative McNamer.
Madam Chair, past history of myself, employee discipline, public employees, difficult thing. I heard a lot of money involved. Could we be countersued? Could the state lose this case?
Mr. Paul.
Well, I'm not quite sure I understand. What case are you talking about?
The case that you're presenting here.
The case.
Mr.
That,
Paul.
Oh, I'm sorry. The case, Madam Chairperson, this is the case that I've been talking about, the public case. I imagine.
Okay. I heard $300,000.
Representative McNamer, there's an ask for $300,000 for additional dollars. And so it's to pay for the process. Mr. Paul, is that correct? So if you want to specifically talk to the money and what the money is used for.
Madam
Mr. Paul.
Yeah, that is correct.
You could clarify that just one more time. So what is the money, how much money, and what is it going to be used
okay.
for? Mr. Paul.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chairperson. It's $300,000. It'll go to a public disciplinary case, which is ongoing, which will be heard beginning on February 25th. And it will also support two disability cases where we are not deciding on misconduct, but deciding on whether or not a judge has a physical or a mental problem which may prevent him or her from doing the job of a judge.
Representative McNamer.
Madam Chair, my concern is, in having this happen before, that we could lose the case and it could come back to haunt us. Am I right about that?
Representative McNamer, these cases are not cases where we are being sued. These are cases where we are investigating, the state is investigating the conduct. And so the question is whether or not there should be disciplinary action or not. And so then are you asking about if the board then goes for disciplinary action and they don't win that case?
That's what I'm asking.
Got it. Mr. Paul, so once your office has gone for disciplinary action to the next level, to the Supreme Court, what happens if the Supreme Court disagrees with you, Mr. Paul?
Madam Chairperson, if the Supreme Court disagrees, it issues its decision, and that's the end of the case. It's not I think I'm getting it now, that it's not a civil suit type of situation where you can sue and countersue. This is a disciplinary matter. It's we call it sui generis in the law. It's just on something onto itself. It's not like anything else, and it's not a question of liability. It's just a question of whether or not discipline should be imposed and what the public requires through the eyes of the Supreme Court.
And Mr. Paul, so when you're determining disability, are those situations where the judge has asked for them or people surrounding the judge has asked that you find this?
Madam Chairperson, that can arise in in both those instances, where people are complaining that a judge is not behaving correctly, and it appears to be a question of a mental or physical problem, or it can be the judge himself or herself. So we get both kinds of cases.
Great. So, members, are there any other questions regarding the budget proposal for this agency? All right. Any other questions? Representative Moline.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Paul, I was just wondering, out of curiosity, can anybody bring, I guess, a complaint about a judge, or, for lack of a better term, does somebody have to have standing? Does it have to be somebody that appeared in front of that judge? Does it have to be an attorney that appeared in front of that judge? Does it have to be a colleague? Or can anybody bring, I guess, to your attention that they have a concern about a judge?
Mr. Paul.
Madam Chairperson, anybody can bring a complaint. We don't look at standing. We look only at allegations. And very often, the people who bring the complaints are anonymous, or there's somebody brings a newspaper article to our attention or something of that nature. The source of the complaint can be from anywhere.
Sorry, Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Point of clarification, please. Am I to understand that the ask is for $300,000 to adjudicate this particular matter plus two others? And I'm wondering if there is, does the legislature have any responsibility to involve itself in this matter?
Mr. Paul, can you explain the $300,000 and what specifically that's going to be used for? And typically, if the legislature checks into the items that they're investigating. Is that a fair? Representative Pugh.
Wondering if this legislative body has an opportunity to, just looking for, are there any alternatives other than to invest in the $300,000 course? Does the legislature, is there any means for us to involve ourselves to bring this to this situation to resolution?
Mr. Paul.
Madam Chairperson, there is no alternative under the rules. Once the case has been filed, it must resolve in the way that the rules call for it to resolve. The judges involved certainly deserve the process, and the board certainly deserves its opportunity to present its case, and that is the procedure that has been selected for the resolution of these cases. The legislature has given the Supreme Court the authority to write the rules that under which we operate and to which I'm referring. And that is what the rules that say as to how to resolve this case. There's no other alternative, and there's no funding alternative for us either. We don't produce anything that can get us any fees, and of course, any place we would get money other than this legislature would not be a very good thing because of the potential conflicts that would be involved.
Representative Pugh, did that answer your question? Mm-hmm. All right. Further questions from members? All right, seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next, members, we're going to hear the budget proposal from the Guardian Ad Litem Board. Welcome to the committee, members. Remember that we have already heard from the Guardian Ad Litem Board about who they are and what they do. This is really to focus on their budget proposals. Again, it is my intention to not have them back again until we put together our budget bill. So if you have questions about their specific budget, please make sure you ask them today. So welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Suzanne Allegro, and I'm the Guardian Ad Litem Program Administrator. Please feel free, as I go through my presentations, if you have questions, please ask them as they arise. As we indicated the last... excuse me, Madam Chair. I think I'll just, you all have copies of the PowerPoint. I think I'll just refer to the PowerPoint. I'm not real good with the using the computer.
Hi.
As we discussed with you the last time we were in front of you, the purpose of the board is to administer a statewide guardian ad litem program that advocates for the best interests. In doing so, we are supporting the statewide outcome of strong and stable families. We had discussed with you when we were in front of you before that the program does operate under both federal and state mandates. Our federal mandate is what's referred to as the CAPTA, Child Abuse Prevention and Treatment Act, and the CAPTA has been around since 1974 and has been reauthorized over the years, amended, the last time being in 2010 with bipartisan support. Additionally, after CAPTA was enacted in 1974, the Minnesota legislature then enacted the guardian ad litem statutes, and those are the state mandates that we operate under. Similar to the federal mandate that the judge must appoint a guardian ad litem in any juvenile case in which a child is alleged to be abused or neglected, the Minnesota mandate has the same language. What the Minnesota law also provides for are guardian ad litems in any child custody, marriage dissolution proceedings where the court has reason to believe that the child is a victim of domestic abuse or neglect. The judge shall appoint a guardian ad litem. Additionally, that same statute, which is Minnesota Statute 518-165, does provide for permissive appointments in family court, and the language is that the proceedings for custody dissolution where parenting or custody time is an issue, that the court may appoint a guardian ad litem to advise on the custody and parenting time issues. As you can imagine, the board does not have the ability to ignore the mandated appointments, and we do have limited ability to ignore the other appointments. There are several key issues that the guardian ad litem board addressed when setting the budget. The first is obviously we want to maintain compliance with our federal and state mandates. The second is to have the guardians perform their duties consistent with the statutes and make sure they're adequately trained. When I was in front of you a couple weeks ago, we did talk to you about our core training programs that all guardians are required to go through. Additionally, they are required to have 15 continuing education credits each year. Certainly, the safety and permanency, as well as cultural education and special needs of the children in individual cases, need to be addressed by the guardian. The board is also aware that the guardian duties be carried out in the most effective and efficient manner in order to best utilize resources. We do certainly share resources across districts, and also I provided some information that I'll go over later in the presentation as far as how we deploy those resources across the state. Also, the board, we are in the process of having a financial audit done to go over our payroll, purchasing, that type of thing, to make sure we're in compliance with all relevant statutes and policies. We also are interested in training partnerships with DHS and other agencies in order to maximize training dollars. Additionally, one of the other things that the board has constantly struggled with is accommodating, as resources permit, the unmet and critical need for guardians to assist with custody cases, especially those involving people without the ability to pay and pro se cases. As far as some of the factors and trends that are affecting the budget, certainly the number and types of guardian ad litem appointments would affect that, and I will go into some of the numbers that the program is experiencing. We've also noticed the growing complexity of the juvenile protection cases, that obviously they involve sexual abuse, addiction, and special needs of children. Again, I've highlighted the diminished ability, the diminished availability and accessibility of professionals in family courts, such as custody evaluators and parenting time expediters. A number of the counties had these programs years ago, and due to county cutbacks, they no longer have these provide custody evaluators, that type of thing. And so the judges increasingly look to the program to provide that service. And as I also indicated, we do see an increasing number of people that do not have the ability to pay, and also more people that are representing themselves. Another factor that affects us in outstate Minnesota is the number of licensed foster care homes in some areas continues to dwindle. This somewhat affects, obviously, our mileage budget, as the guardians do need to make home visits to where the child is placed. Another thing it does affect our resources are staffing alternative programs such as signs of safety, drug courts, and family group decision making. Although we really feel these programs are very worthwhile and they do end up with better outcomes, they are rather labor intensive. The other thing that has affected our budget is transition from the contractor model to the employee model. I think I talked about that prior to July 1st of 2010, across the state, most of the programs had independent contractors that were serving as guardian ad litem. Some employees, and Hennepin and Ramsey had volunteers. The court, prior to turning the program over to the independent board, decided to that independent contractors would no longer serve as guardians. And so now in all the programs, we either have employees or volunteers, again, in Hennepin and Ramsey. And also, as with most of the state agencies, we are facing increasing insurance costs. On page 9, I provided statewide new cases filed by case type. And just over the years, from 08 to 09, the caseload went up. It went down a little bit.
No questions? Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had a question on the increasing insurance costs. Was that health insurance? What kind of insurance were you referring to in that?
Ms. Allegro.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, yes, health insurance that we were projecting a 9% increase January 1st of this year, 9.9 January 1st of 2014, and 9.9 January 1st of 2015.
Representative Scott.
And thank you, Madam Chair. And so 2013, was your estimate pretty accurate? Is that about what it went up, was the 9.8 or whatever you mentioned? Or because I'm assuming you have... You know now what 2013 is going to cost you.
Ms. Allegro.
Madam Chair, I know I do not know at this point.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. I just have a quick question about the philosophy behind changing from contractors to employees. At least in my experience in the private sector, it's more expensive to have employees. Was there a fiscal reason or other reasons?
Ms. Allegro.
Madam Chair, Representative O'Neill, you're correct. It is more expensive to have employees versus contractors. I think even though the employees were making a little bit more hourly rate as an independent contractor, they did take a pay cut, an hourly pay cut, but there's increased, FICA, if they are insurance eligible. We now pay their mileage, home office expenses. I believe the issue with the court, and they had studied it quite intently, was that I think the feeling that in order to properly supervise the guardian ad litem, they needed to be employees as opposed to independent contractors. Mm-hmm. But as I said, that decision was made prior to my coming on.
Representative O'Neill, actually, that was my bill. The court actually, it originally was under the court's jurisdiction, and the goal was to actually make a separate board to bring folks on as employees to have more uniformity across the state, because you had some folks that had guardians, others that were short on them, some that had some training, others that had little or none. And so it was an attempt to make this program much more streamlined and consistent across the state. Representative O'Neill.
Can I ask Chairwoman a question then?
Certainly.
A little unusual, but a fiscal note on that bill, was there an added cost to the state? Or
Representative O'Neill, there was a fiscal note. I don't remember exactly what the fiscal note was, but I am certain that we accounted for the additional costs in insurance and things of that nature when we did the bill. It went through a number of committees. It took a while. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairwoman.
Ms. Allegro.
Madam Chair, could I just add to that, that yes, when the chair is correct, when the program switched from the court system to the independent board, I think it was with the understanding that it would be pretty much cost neutral. And so we have provided for, they are getting the additional costs and that type of thing within the existing budget.
Right, and actually, Representative O'Neill, there was a cut as well in the last budget round to the guardian ad litem board. They were one of the two areas that took a budget cut in the last section. So, Ms. Allegra, if you could actually take us through, you can take us through your statistics as well, but at some point we'd like you to take us through the budget numbers in the budget book.
If
Ms.
you would,
Ms. Allegra.
Madam Chair, if you'd like, starting on page 12, I can give you the budget history and then talk about the budget request. What I've laid out is the budget history from FY 09 through 13. And that was basically, as you can see, there was a slight increase over the years. And then as the chair pointed out, last year's budget, there was a decrease of $300,000 each year of the biennium. What our request is this year, our base budget for the two-year period is $24 million, and we had a requested increase of $1.2 million. And so the total request was a little over $25 million. On the next page, I've broken out what the request was for, and it was basically for increased insurance costs, and we are looking at employee compensation in the form of across-the-board increases. We had requested 1.266, and the governor's proposal was to fully fund the compensation increases and partially fund the insurance increases. There may be, and then the question is has been asked about the employee compensation, why that's higher in FY15, and that's because we were requesting compensation increases for both years.
Questions from members? Representative Driskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Allegra, what was, back to your last statement, what was the amount of, as a percentage basis, how much is the employee compensation increase in each of those 2 years?
Ms. Allegra.
Madam Chair, Representative Driskowski, it's 3% each year.
Representative Driskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Questions from members? So could you, Ms. Allegro, could you just clarify how many employees now that the guardian ad litem program has in terms of FTE? Do you know?
Yes. Madam Chair, if you turn to page 15 of the handout, what I've done is broken the by district program, by job classification, for each job classification, the number of full-time equivalents in that job classification, and then the number of employees that are filling those full-time equivalents. And this is just basically to show that we, overall, we have 170.39 full-time equivalents, and 248 employees are filling those positions. So we do have, most of our employees are part-time, and I think we have about, it's about a third to two-thirds. But so this would be a breakdown, as I said, by classification, full-time equivalents, and number of employees.
Questions from members? Representative Driskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Allegra, in the earlier testimony from you or the Guardian Lighting Program, I don't remember, you were with us at that day, thank you. There was discussion about the social worker and duplication of services between them. Have you taken a closer look at that? Are there ways for us to reduce some of the redundancy that appears to be happening there?
Ms. Allegra.
Madam Chair, Representative Drakowski, I think we fulfill a different role, that again, the guardians are charged with the unique role of advocating for the best interests of the child. The social worker focus may be a little different. We are, as I indicated, operating under mandates, and so I don't know if that, I think that's our position, is we really kind of, I was sharing with one of the members that I think maybe the best way to explain it, we are really, our focus is on the child. I think the social worker needs to sometimes focus on the parents to make, not, they certainly focus on the child, but they need to ensure that the parents follow the case plan and that type of thing. Our focus is really on the child, and I think the judges recognize the unique role that we bring to the proceedings.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Ms. Allegra, when you have the social worker and the guardian ad litem, two different social worker types, apparently involved in what you described as two different roles, where does the judge typically, you know, who does the judge typically side with in terms of determining who's, you know, which of them represents the best interests of the child?
Ms. Allegra.
Madam Chair, Representative Drazkowski, I don't have any hard statistics on that.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Ms. Allegra, the full-time employees, you mentioned earlier you got 71 full-time employees. How many of those are administrative staff?
Ms. Allegra.
Madam Chair, Representative Drazkowski, on the chart it would be, we have myself would be considered administrative. We have 10 program managers, one in each judicial district, and we have reduced that. We used to have 11 when we took the program over, and we reduced that by one. And then we do have guardian ad litem coordinators, and they're the frontline supervisors, and we have 22.
Representative Drazkowski.
So, Ms. Allegra, 22 out of 71 is what I think I heard there. 22 out of... It's 171. Okay, thank you. So, Ms. Allegra, how about the part-time staff? What percentage of the part-time staff are guardian ad litems, and what percent are what percent of the part-time employees are administrative versus guardian ad litems?
Ms. Allegra.
Madam Chair, Representative Drazkowski, we have most of the part-time staff are guardian ad litems. We do have some staff that administrative assistants, that type of thing, if you consider them administrative. And I guess I should clarify that when I was looking at administrative, I was looking at managerial as opposed to maybe administrative, and I think sometimes those terms get confused. So managerial, if I could clarify, we have 10 program managers, 22 coordinators, and myself. And then we do have some, maybe what we call very few administrative staff, a number of the, most of those are part-time. And then we have a number of the guardian ad litems, and most of the guardian ad litems are part-time.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Lean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Allegro, I was just noticing some of the positions in some of the districts are different. For example, you have an intern professional in District 5, a volunteer coordinator in District 4. How is some of that determination made based on what positions are filled in which district? Is it by caseload? Is it by population of the district?
Ms. Allegro.
Madam Chair, Representative, I think it's basically the needs of the district. For example, Hennepin County has over 200 volunteers, so they obviously do need a volunteer coordinator. In Ramsey County, where they do have a number of volunteers, but they don't have as many, one of the coordinators does that halftime. And then it's just basically some of the needs of the district are a little different.
Representative Lean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so I guess another question would be, do you account for the employment positions and then the budgeting based on the availability of volunteers or interns or things based on past projections? Is that something you can rely on?
Ms. Allegro.
Chair, Representative, I think with the volunteers, we pretty much know from year to year they're able to get the same number of volunteers, so it really hasn't affected the staffing level of with the guardian ad litems in those districts. I would say with the intern, he's a .10, and I think he was mainly brought on to help us with some technology issues.
Representative Lane.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And one more question. What sorts of roles do the volunteers take up? Is it kind of general office administrative work, or is it more field work, kind of front-end service work?
Ms. Allegro.
Madam Chair, Representative Lean, it is actually they work as guardian ad litems only in juvenile court. We don't have any volunteers working in family court.
Thank you.
Further questions? Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Madam Chair, this might be reviewing Ms. Allegra's response to me at the first hearing, of which I don't remember all the details of her response. But the question is, if we were to look at removing some of the state mandates, you mentioned state and federal mandates dictate your direction, your budget, et cetera. If we were to remove those, what would be the or a portion of them, what would be our options in that area?
Ms. Allegro.
Madam Chair, Representative Drakowski, I assume, you know, the federal mandate, obviously, that's a little more difficult to do anything with, as you can imagine. And the state mandate, as they say, for juvenile cases pretty much mirrors the federal. I guess your options might be then to look at whether you wanted to do anything with either the mandated or the permissive family court statute.
Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Allegra, what percentage of your work does that area represent?
Ms. Allegro.
Madam Chair, Representative, if you say,
if you need to get us some of those statistics, you can provide them.
I don't really want to do the math in my head, but I could certainly get that for you, for the committee.
Thank you, Ms. Allegro, and Madam Chair.
Thank you. So, Ms. Allegro, if you could actually get that information for us and provide that to the committee, I will make certain that I provide it to the members. Further questions from members? All right, seeing none, thank you. Members, do any of the members have any questions for nonpartisan staff regarding this section of the budget? Anyone need nonpartisan staff to go through the fiscal staff to go through it? All right. Next up, we have the Uniform Laws Commission. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record, and go ahead.
Thank you. My name is Robert Tennyson. I'm an attorney in Minneapolis. I'm a member of the Uniform Law Commission from Minnesota. I've dispensed with some of the issues early. We don't have any employees. We don't have any space. We don't have any salary. We don't have any payroll. So none of those questions apply. We don't have health insurance. We're all volunteers, and we provide service to the state and to the nation. Our budget request, the governor proposed $49,000 a year. Let me explain why that's not accurate or why it's not adequate. There are two items of expense for the conference, or for the commissioners. One is the annual dues to the national conference, which are $54,000 for each of the next 2 years. And we're statutorily required to attend the annual meeting of the conference at which the work goes on in the conference, where the draft acts are up for debate. And I've explained that to you, I think, in a video that we showed you a while back, and also some of the other things. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have about that. I've estimated that the cost of the attendance at the annual meeting for the next 2 years will be $30,000 each. So our request is $84,000. And for that, you get over $3,000 of volunteer time from the commissioners. You also get the benefit of the 350 commissioners from around the country who participate in this process in developing the acts that we bring to you. And in addition, we, because of the budget cuts the last several years, we've not paid our dues in full. So there's arrearages for 2012, 2011, and 2004 to 2007, which add up to about $63,000. And we'd like to have that paid. Part of the problem is an embarrassment. The immediate past president, Bob Stein, and the incoming president this summer will be Harriet Lancer from Minnesota. And I served on the executive committee for a long time and also chaired the legislative committee. And one of our jobs was to persuade all the states to pay their dues. So when we were asking them to pay their dues and we weren't, it's a bit embarrassing when you're in a leadership position. But for the work we do, the quality of the product we get, and the benefit to the state, the $84,000 is a pretty small amount of money, and it's a good bargain for the state. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions from members?
If anybody has any questions, please feel free to call me later, too.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Members, that concludes the testimony for today. So tomorrow, again, will be a shorter hearing. We have one bill on tomorrow. The public defenders were going to be presenting. Now they have a conflict, so we only have one budget section. So please bring your budget book to committee. And with that, members, we need to approve the minutes. Is there a motion?
I'll move the minutes, Madam Chair.
Representative Scott moves the minutes. Any errors or corrections? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Members, we are adjourned.